We are excited to have Reverend Karen Hutt present Have You Ever Said White Trash?, which is related to our first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Reverend Hutt has been a UU minister for 25 years and has served churches in Chicago and is currently serving in a part-time capacity at First Universalist in Minneapolis. She is also Vice President of Student Formation, Vocation, and Innovation at United Theology Seminary of the Twin Cities. She lives in Minneapolis with her partner, Reverend Ashley Horan, and their three children, Z, Aspen, and Eden. Sorry if I got those names wrong. So welcome, Karen.
Thank you. It's so nice to be with you all. I love the idea of being able to travel around the country and preach. It's been my dream, but I didn't know it would be by Zoom. So thank you for welcoming me, and it's a pleasure to visit with you today in all of your glory and all of your homes. Feels very intimate and warm, and we had a wonderful chit-chat before we started. So again, many thanks. I'm going to take you on a little trip today. And this is a number of years ago with my mom in Atlanta, Georgia, who was in graduate school at the time. She said it would be a short drive to one of my cousin's house because she would take a shortcut through a place called Cabbage Town, just outside of Atlanta. As I looked out of the window searching for cabbages along the highway, I saw a long, low set of houses on a sandy red clay. And I saw an old mill and lots of old cars on the lawn with men and women and children standing around while everyone was playing in the dirt. This was the first time that I had laid eyes on these people. And my curiosity kept my head pressed against the window in the back seat. It was late, and my dad was finishing up work at his office in downtown Philadelphia, and a man came up to him on Broad Street with tousled blonde hair and asked my dad if he could spare some change. I was stunned that this man was asking my dad for money. I stared at him in a very disappointed manner when I noticed him give him some loose change from his pocket that I had just asked for an hour earlier. As the man walked away, I stared at him curiously, wondering why this man was a beggar. My great-grandfather, whose father was an enslaved person, liked to tell stories. One day he was telling us a story about something, and he looked to the adults in the room and said, "Well, you know, they ain't nothing but poor white trash." And everybody laughed. I laughed too, but not sure what I was laughing at until many, many years later in South Boston. There, I was working with white youth living in public housing. One afternoon, I went into the home of one of the kids I was working with, and the mom directs me to sit down. I look down and I see I'm about to take a seat in a whole front seat bench of a Mustang that was serving as a couch. I sat down carefully, as if traveling in a foreign land, waiting for some social cues to guide my next move in this strange place that I was visiting. These were people that I brushed up against, drove by, and heard about. These were the other white people. These were the white people that I and everyone around me had nothing but disdain for. They were the butt of our jokes as we watched the Beverly Hillbillies and Hee Haw as kids. Later, they morphed into Honey Boo Boo and Duck Dynasty that became pop culture junk food that accompanied my craft beer at an art opening. These were the one group of people that my upper middle class friends of all backgrounds could agree that we were better than. Now, according to Nancy Eisenberg, author of White Trash, The Untold 500-Year History of Class in America, My attitudes about this population had been carefully curated by the deliberate myths of noble Puritans, bronze statues, and the delusion that America is a classless society. These childhood fantasies and falsehoods about America's bootstrap options for white people over time gave way to the truth that this is indeed a class-based society. Long before Occupy Wall Street or Bernie Sanders, long before we were a country at all, this has been the case. In White Trash, Eisenberg takes a very particular look at class in the United States, examining the white outcast who politicians from Andrew Jackson to Donald Trump have sought to rally, but whose otherwise have remained vilified, shunned, targeted, and kept apart, both physically in poorhouses and trailer parks through eugenic science and discriminatory public policy, and in the nation's cultural imagination, where they have inspired mockery, kitsch, and unceasing grimaces and eye rolling. One of America's founding myths, of course, is that the simple act of leaving England and boldly starting new lives in the colonies had an equalizing effect on the colonists, swiftly narrowing the distance between indentured servant and merchant, landowner and clerk. We Americans were taught to believe the New World was seen as a land of freedom and possibility. The truth is, it was widely viewed as an unproductive wasteland, an ideal place to ship Europe's deplorables. While some Europeans did cross the Atlantic to seek religious or political freedom, as they saw it, many more came as convicts, prostitutes, orphans, and indentured servants. In 1619, King James I was so fed up with the vagrant boys milling around his new marketplace that he asked the Virginia Company to ship them overseas. 3 years later, John Donne, you know, that John Donne, the wonderful poet, wrote about the colony of Virginia as if it were England's spleen and liver, draining, as he says, the ill humors of the body to breed good blood. Colonial America was a place where the surplus poor, the waste people of England, could be converted into economic assets. England's most destitute city dwellers were sent here, including children, many, many children, shipped to the colonies in a practice known as spiriting, creating a class of white laborers that served as disposable property, including the story, which I found so interesting, of one little kid named Little Bess Armstrong, who was sent to Virginia for stealing two spoons. Our founding fathers had very little faith in the capacity of the poor white man. Benjamin Franklin opposed giving alms to them or anyone who was unemployed and poor, fearing it would encourage them to be idle. Thomas Jefferson urged the creation of a uniquely American stock of hardworking, virtuous citizens, and thought that those who did not measure up were like livestock, unfit for breeding. The poor were seen as expendable, deserving of scorn. Listen to the names that were used to describe them: waste people, offscourings, lovers, bog trotters, rascals, rubbish, squatters, crackers, clay eaters, tackies, mudsills, scallywags, briar hoppers, hillbillies, lowdowners, white niggers, degenerates, white trash, rednecks, trailer trash, swamp people. Capital and ownership determined the social pecking order. Hereditary titles may have gradually disappeared in our country, but large land grants and land titles remain central to the American system of privilege. Now, White Trash, this book by Nancy Eisenberg, she's a professor of history at Louisiana State University, is really cringeworthy. It's a cringeworthy history lesson, a chronology of a caste system that has existed in our country since the first Europeans arrived on the eastern shore some four centuries ago. Second, it is an effort to explain why some white people seem hopelessly relegated to the lower rung on the economic ladder, a position that has as much to do with cultural heritage as it does with financial resources and education. Finally, I believe that this book is a cautionary tale about how poor white people are manipulated systematically and purposefully to be excluded from the full participation in the society we live in. Poor white people are reminded every day at Wall Street, Silicon Valley, Washington, D.C., and Hollywood, we get along just fine without them. And if very few people are willing to make a genuine effort to get to know who they are or improve their well-being. Meanwhile, it's statistically probable that their wages are stagnant, your kids' education is subpar, their water is at risk of sudden chemical poisoning, mom maybe drinks too much, and dads are dying from what now the Center for Disease Control calls deaths of despair, a new category of death based on the activities of this population. Poor white trash means unwanted, disposable, non-human. Whether we admit it or not, we have come to accept white trash as an inevitability. Like the trash in our kitchens, we stick it as far away from us as possible so we don't have to smell it. When I experienced a re-education reading this book, there were a few questions that kept me up at night that I want to share with you now. The first question was, why was I, this Black, upper middle class, East Coast educated, East Coast born and raised, non-poor person, so interested in poor white people? Was it the gaze at Cabbage Town and the stories of my great-grandfather and the car seat couches that made me a voyeur, peeking into the windows of white poverty to understand why these white people couldn't seemingly take advantage of and reap the fruits of being white in America? With every new fact of their oppression in this book, I had a strange schizophrenic compassion for these people, who are the victims of a similar system and ideology that exploits me and my people. In fact, when I read it, there was this moment of, one of the things I was so stunned by was that there was a whole movement to sterilize poor white women in the 1930s. How many of us know about that from history? A move to sterilize poor white women in the 1930s and serious academic attempts, I mean journals and conferences were organized at that time to classify poor white people as a separate race. Serious academic endeavors. I smiled, dreaming that if more people knew this history, maybe it could spark the multiracial poor people's movement of Dr. King and get our suffering connected through oppressive policies and twisted beliefs. But that smile quickly gave way to my lived experience of those angry white faces. Because so many of them have been angry at me. Why? One angry white face of a poor white person I remember in particular. Some of you may remember this as well. It was a vicious face of a 15-year-old white girl standing behind a 15-year-old Black girl walking to her newly integrated school in Little Rock, Arkansas, 1957. You may remember that face. You can look it up and you'll remember it instantly. But now I wanted to know who she was after reading this book. Who was that angry white girl screaming at a Black girl going to school? I did some research and found out that that white woman's name was Hazel Bryan, who in 1958 would drop out of school, marry and live in a trailer. Her father was a disabled veteran, unable to work, Her mother held a job at the Westinghouse plant. Neither of her parents had finished high school. But Hazel was the face of Southern white trash from that era. Ignorant, unrepentant, congenitally cruel. But the real story behind Hazel Bryant is that white elites rigged the system so poor whites got slightly better schools, slightly better jobs, slightly better homes, and then were expected to defend those privileges against people of color, often violently. Poor whites ended up with the short end of the stick, but they fought in the knowledge that at least they were better off than the black counterparts that got nothing. President Johnson, Lyndon Johnson, says you can take the poorest white man and tell him he's better than the Negro, all while the banks are picking their pockets. I soon realized that my fascination with poor white people came from my early affiliation with the more radical UUs of Boston when I was in college. The Communist Party USA, the Student Mobilization Committee to End the War, and the Socialist Workers Party. For I had a sincere and passionate desire to see a multiracial revolution develop in this country that would wake and shake these particular white people to join me and seek economic justice for all citizens. I still haven't woken up from that dream. The second question that kept me up was, why am I so unsatisfied with conversations that I have with white UUs when I bring up class problems in Unitarian Universalism? We rarely discuss it. And when we do, we often focus on the theoretical poor and the nameless homeless. When I advocate for the poor white man, I get really strange and curious looks. When I ask, why don't you bring that cousin of yours that you don't talk to because they voted for Trump to church? I get dismissed as being ridiculous. As if these white people undergoing the travail and disenfranchisement deserve little empathy. Their inherent worth and dignity is not recognized. I have heard UUs refer to these cousins as layabouts drenched in self-pity or described as sad cases consumed with racial status animosity and anxiety towards the non-whites passing them on the economic ladder. Sure. These comments by my white UU siblings are strikingly ungenerous towards a huge number of fellow Americans. Yet, Unitarian Universalists like being allies to people of color. Some are armchair allies that watch Rachel Maddow and listen to Amy Goodman religiously. Some are cocktail party allies with the Merlot in one hand, comparing their protest logs in the other and their financial contributions to Black Lives Matter. And of course, there are those who have gone full in and immersed themselves in people of color culture to gain a deeper empathy for the struggle. And they even move into people of color neighborhoods only to eventually gentrify them through their tacit demands for goat cheese and better coffee at the corner store. Friends, we can reconcile the rhetoric of a universal free faith with the reality of our present class-bound composition and our self-serving and selective alliances. Can we do that? Can we empathize with the working class, particularly the ones suffering from what Marx called as alienation? Think about it. If you're a skilled craftsperson and you like to work with your hands, you might be a UU. But if you make a living by renting your muscles and selling your time as a mover permanently, not just until your novel gets published, you probably aren't a UU. Every survey of our movement has demonstrated beyond question and peculiar, it's our very peculiar class structure. We are, whether we recognize it or not, still tied as we are to colleges and universities and the dominant professional groups in this country. So friends, I'd like to suggest that our class identity may be less a result of wealth than the consequence of education. But because we are a movement, I firmly believe that we can transform and evolve beyond being stuck in this education bubble. And we can reframe our positions to extend our belief in the inherent worth and dignity to those white people we have never, ever considered worthy enough to speak to or spend time with. When I sat in that car couch in South Boston, I realized how far the UUA headquarters on Beacon Hill was from these people's reality. It's like 3 miles. The scope of the world of those in Southie was limited because of deliberate policy that kept them out of sight from the Boston Brahmins. But this UU did not just connect the sociological and political dots of their existence. I connected in relationship to this family in Southie by listening to their story, eating fish with them, drinking canned Schlitz with them, sharing a laugh with these folks that were stereotyped as too racist, too stupid, too whatever, to engage across race and class. More of us need to do this. And the good news is that in the last few years, class conversations are emerging in our association as they are providing tools for us to examine the class hegemony that keeps us creating for our multi-class communities. The UU Class Conversations website describes in detail how UUs need greater awareness of class, and they provide practical things that a congregation can do to address these issues and these assumptions. For instance, they pose the following question, which I love. Does your congregation or do your committees require leaders to spend their own money and then be reimbursed for things? Think about it. This prohibits people without funds from rising leadership. Do your members start off asking the question, which I totally am at fault at because I'm from the East Coast, and the first question I ask someone is, what do you do? What do you do? What makes you worthy? Does the water ceremony always have to talk about places that we have traveled to? Bali, Greece. Are all of our meetings and events geared towards people with 9-to-5 jobs? How does someone with a 3-to-11 shift get to participate in the life of your church? Are meetings and events held at the church, or is it hosting things at people's homes, something remember we used to do, part of your culture? How does this feel for someone who can never host because they don't think anyone wants to come to their zip code? How do you speak about ethical obligations? Are you making people who can't afford ethical eating marginalized? Are you proposing that you present things that are ethical obligations which are financially impossible for many people, or laying on the guilt? I'll never forget visiting a church once, and I observed this. It was a new person that came to the church, and she wanted to contribute to coffee hour, so she brought in a big can of Folgers that she had gotten from Costco. It had that Costco look to it, giant coffee. And when she went into the kitchen, which I was adjacent to, sipping a cup of coffee, she says, oh, I brought this for you guys. It's so nice to be a part of this community. And two women in the kitchen says, well, we would never use that kind of coffee. It's not fair trade coffee. And the woman took her coffee and walked out of the door and never probably came back. Equality is simultaneously, friends, the greatest joy of American culture is trying to seek that equality, trying to find it. Where is it? Will it ever be here? Will we ever live in it? But it's also an illusion sometimes. We think that we're going to be moving towards creating this great movement. It's going to be so inclusive, but we end up creating bubbles. Bubbles that we remain in. Bubbles that are impenetrable to those who are different from us. Have you done that? Have you thought about inviting someone to this church, to this community who's from a different class background? We need to follow the lead of some of the things going on in the UU class conversations because they give us opportunities to figure out how we're going to move forward. And despite the glossy veneer of liberalism, which has been painted over the rust and corrosion of centuries of racism and classism, the enduring American necessity for a social other has chosen working class whites as the focal scapegoat of our time. So I want to remind us that our theology has a vision of beginning the world anew. And this must be with all kinds of people, not just with our social circle that we create or like-minded liberals. It must be practiced in an ever-intentional manner, in an ever-widening circles, if our faith is going to be truly transformational and relevant in the days to come. Perhaps this is how Unitarian Universalism can fulfill its democratic vision and become more than a faith for a few. But it requires us to remain conscious of our biases. Rather than having conversations about how we as haves can invite the have-nots to share our churches, can we instead have conversations which say, this is what we believe all in our church should be able to do. Now, how do we make that possible? As we enter this critical juncture over the next few months in our country's history, we need to forget charity and embrace a new form of solidarity to be transformed. Our resistance as Unitarian Universalists must include our own transformation, both internally and externally. Our resistance needs to resist everything about the current ruling class, especially their exclusivity. As we challenge the Trumpian values of indifference, we can't cherry pick which people to include and empathize with. Call them white trash, rubbish, rednecks, townies, hillbillies, or call them Gary from Ohio, who dropped out of college because he couldn't afford it, or he got frustrated taking remedial reading classes. His career choices of factory worker, bartender, busboy, retail clerk, or gas station clerk, day laborer, janitor, it's not really a choice, is it? He is our neighbor, he is our brother, he is our fellow citizen, and his inability to make a decent living in this town or any town is due to circumstances and attitudes and policies far outside his control that were set in motion hundreds of years ago as little Elizabeth was spirited away from England. And they haven't changed much. So as you prepare to block or delete that relative you cannot reason with, think about beginning the world anew by giving our UU values and our principles and our sources a muscular and compassionate workout for the sake of our democratic republic before it's too late. It's up to you. Amen.
Thanks so much, Karen.
It's exactly what Eisenberg has tons of detail about in her book. Strongly recommend. It's a great read. And it's on audiobook too, so you can listen to it while you're exercising. If you shared anything from her research, I learned a new story. And there are a number of stories in there about women in particular who've been sterilized and were taken to these god-awful places, or even being arrested for indeterminate amounts of time and just held in jails. The oppression of women in through this too, because they didn't want them to give birth because they thought that they were just not worthy. Fascinating. It's by Nancy Eisenberg, and it's White Trash, the 400-year-old untold history of class in America. And she's at Louisiana State University. I don't know the press, though. It's easy. You'll just Google it. It'll be right there. And there's a wonderful interview with her on YouTube, too, talking about the book, which is really great. She's very, very personable. Well, first of all, as a non-white person, I look at this through an anthropological lens, looking at white people. You know, I have an anthropological view as a distant observer. I've always been that. One thing that I've been doing is that I have a number of personas. I've been doing this since I predicted that Trump would win.
I was the one person in my office. I worked at the University of Minnesota Medical Center. I was a teaching chaplaincy to students. I was a staff of 30 white people and me. I was the only black person on the staff. I was the only one who thought Trump would win. They all laughed at me for the whole year. And I said, well, you want to laugh? You know, look, I'm from Philly. Put some money where that was. So I made a bet with them. So we had a little pool going. And, you know, I won quite a few $100s at the end of that. And everyone was home crying the next day. And I was kind of, I said, I think I'm going to take myself out to a fancy dinner. So anyway, I jest. But what I've been doing since then, and even before then, number one, I listen to a lot of right-wing radio, and I watch Fox News in between all the other things. And I've also created like 3 or 4 different personas online that are, so I am in about half a dozen Trump 2020, I'm in the Minnesota Women for Trump, I'm in all these Facebook groups. And as another person, not as my name, because I'm easy to Google and they can see who I am. But I've created this persona to go in there to see what people are talking about amongst themselves without the conflict of family drama that you're talking about, Karen, because it's relatives, it's different, you know, because it's family. It's a little complicated as always. And I ask questions. I don't argue with them. I ask questions. And sometimes when I ask these questions, I get some surprising answers. Number one, I find out there's this one woman that's been saying all these horrible things, has biracial grandchildren that she adores. There's a lot of people in Wisconsin, this one that I'm in, that I think it's a Wisconsin, they have a militia up there in northern Wisconsin. You have a lot of white supremacy kind of groups in Wisconsin that are connected to this other group that I'm in that's in Michigan, which is a more of a white supremacist kind of a group. But one thing I suggest doing is, number one, listening and engaging. It's obviously the people are just like regurgitating things that they see, but asking questions, I find myself engaged a little bit besides making statements to them. And again, it's my anthropological view. I'm distant, I'm black, I'm not engaged with them at an emotional level, but I'm curious about them. And I think a lot of liberal folks get so frustrated that there's just this anger at them as opposed to curiosity. Like, so, okay, so you think this, so tell me about, you know, and then they'll tell you about a black person they work with that they love. I mean, it's just, it's very complicated. It's not as cut and dry as we think it is. I used to think it was, but I worked in South Boston during the 80s when the busing was going on. I don't know if any of you remember what seeing Boston it was like then. I was right in the midst of all of that in the most racist neighborhood, South Boston, I could be in. The people were more complicated than just what we had seen or their little quick tropes that they would spell out against black people. Even that woman, Hazel Bryan, the woman, you know that angry picture of the white girl that I described in this talk. Later on in life, she went and met the girl that she was screaming at, like 30 years later. And they actually formed a relationship. It's a fascinating story of this change that happens in people. I'd ask Karen, about the hordes of Irish. I don't know what your background is, but you know, the Irish were considered not white when they came to this country. You know, I'd remind your cousin of that. I don't know what your ethnic background is, but
on that side of the family, it's Scott.
Okay. Yeah, same. A lot of that, too. Yeah. And Scotch-Irish, too. I would remind people of their own history and remind people of things that were said about them. Remind them. Read this book and then send some notes about how the ruling class has used poor white people and manipulated them for so long. Now, of course, they don't want to hear that they're manipulated because it's a cognitive dissonance going on with all of these folks right now as reality of things are just, they can't absorb reality because they bought into this narrative that they can't let go of because they're holding on to the security of Trump because he represents you know, father, he represents them. He represents the guy at the end of the bar who talks crazy. And they recognize that as a basic, but it's not president, you know, it's not somebody you want to be president, the guy at the end of the bar who's just mouthing off. But there's an identity connection there too. So even asking about that, what is it about him that inspires you? Now, obviously, I'm asking this from a totally different kind of perspective, but be curious about these folks instead of just yelling at them. In the same way that you're curious about people of color, be curious about them, because, you know, you're not going to know us as well as you're going to know your own relatives. The opportunities for people of color and white people to really live together in community are far fewer than they are for you to live together in community with your working class and poor white neighbors, because 80% of America would have to move in order to integrate it, and no one's moving. I think that it is a very hard term for poor whites to really get behind. I mean, you could get real, I think I've seen white liberals and progressives get very granular with this. But okay, you don't have anything, but you have privilege because you won't get maybe shot by the police. So it becomes very much activity specific or behavioral specific, as opposed to, within a structure of economics about what privilege is. So yeah, I can see that definitely does not always fly. I mean, I debate with my progressive white brothers and sisters all the time, even in my own church, because I take a little bit different position on some of these things. But I just think we have to be a little more nuanced in our thinking. I think there's a certain tendency that you use right now to be rather strident about being on the right side of history without looking at the complexities of issues, and also utilizing our faith and our history of complexity. There were slave owners. I mean, come on now. It's all, you know, let's look at who we are. Let's not have a fantasy about who we are. We have UUs that absolutely had nothing but disdain for poor white people. That's been our history. But we've also keep evolving, and let's keep it doing, keep transforming, keep evolving, but not forgetting, you know, that we're a work in progress. But don't give up, and don't become so strident that we can't embrace other people. It can be done. I know it can be, but we have to do it in love and true concern and modeling of our behavior. We cannot say we believe in the inherent worth and dignity and block, you know, somebody who has a different view than we do because it unnerves us. We're so prickly sometimes, we don't let people seep into our worlds as much. I do more of that than a lot of, I spend more time with working class white people online and racist online and white supremacists online, trying to understand who they are as people, than my white brothers and sisters. It's been very instructive. I've learned a lot. I've actually made one or two like Facebook friends with some of these people who don't know who I am really, but they know I am a minister on that line. I'm serving as a minister. I ask questions and I encourage people. Somebody had a long thing one day about their mother dying of COVID and just being alone. And I just ministered to her. And she really appreciated it. Now, she knew I was a black UU minister who's a humanist. They probably had a heart attack, but it's okay. It's all right. It just made a connection. Well, I am not Nate Silver. You know who he is, everyone. Yeah. Nate Silver is like this brilliant analyst about voting. So I believe that his base has eroded some with independents who are key and some of those Democrats that voted. But it really comes down to five states. Your state is key. I mean, who wins in Wisconsin? Who wins in Michigan? Who wins in Florida? It's really just the five states that are the pivotal things. The rest of the country doesn't really even matter. We know what they're going to vote for. But those five states to watch. And yours is a critical one. In fact, one county in your state is probably going to be the telling of it all. I forget the name of it, but my partner, Ashley Horan, is also a UU minister, and she's in charge of the UUA's social, she's the organizing and strategic director for social justice and is head of the UU The Vote program. And, you know, everyone thinks that Biden will win, but if they cheat and if they suppress the vote the way we know they're going to do, if the Russians do what they are doing already, I think he'll win again. If they cheat, which I think they'll cheat.
They're going to try.
Cheating is the key. All right. Oh, they are already doing it. They're already doing it. Voter suppression is, because 36 governors are Republicans. You know, maybe six or seven of them are reasonable human beings. The state election commissioners in almost all the states are Republicans. So they can eliminate voting machines. They can set them up. They can do anything. There's a wonderful book by the guy who worked for Cambridge Analytica that talks about how the Russian troll factories in St. Petersburg, it's called Mind Fucked, but basically it's a wonderful book by one of those whistleblowers from Cambridge Analytica about how they do it. It's fascinating. So that's my prediction is if they cheat, Trump will win. If they don't, because he's desperate to not go to jail. So they'll do anything. They'll do anything to win. They'll do anything. And we can't, like, might be naive. So it's up to Wisconsin. Well, this is a conversation amongst white people to have. I mean, what do you guys think? I mean, this is really up to you. I mean, it's not anything that I can do about that, because this is really an internal issue, which I think is kind of fun about me preaching about this, which is sort of counterintuitive, you know, because, you know, I'm talking about something that's amongst yourselves. So if you all are committed to this kind of systemic change, you're going to need those people, first of all. You're going to have to convince them, come to somewhere where they are, and spend time reminding them of the union movements in the 1930s and 40s where people were included in working together, of the work of Paul Robeson. I mean, there are a lot of examples in our history, and even during slavery, you know, stories about John Brown. I mean, all of these, there's a plenty of American history that can teach us how to do some of this. There are moments in American history that we have. And I think that's one of the ahistorical nature of our culture makes us forget that, and we feel like we're at a loss for, like, what do we do? Well, let's look back and see what people have done. And then what kind of new creations can we make? I think the thing that'll have to happen, one of two things will happen. One will be a really total economic collapse because of COVID, and with 45 million people out of work, you know, that's a lot of white people that are out of work. We know how we know black people, we're going to be at the bottom of everything all the time. So we don't really, this doesn't really phase us in the same way. We're dying. We've always died. We've always been at the bottom of everything. So we will survive. But for you white people, this will be, for some of them, a big surprise to be unemployed this long or to have such hardship. So what they do with that anxiety, do they come and kill me like so many want to or do? Or are you going to examine anything? It's up to you who can help them and get to know them and spend time with them to try to stop that from happening to me. Because it's only you who'll be able to stop them from killing me. Or this turning into an apartheid situation when the country in 2045 turns to a majority of people of color country, because of the demographic shifts. So you guys have a lot of work.
No,
I don't see any other way.
Yeah, thanks so much for the presentation and discussion today. I think
thank you for having me. I'm sorry I'm so long-winded.
Just right.
I gotta go to my coffee hour at my church. Nice meeting you all. I hope to see you in real time someday. Come visit you up there in Madison.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye. Take care.